The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Clinical oncology, physical diagnosis, systemic manifestations, and chemotherapy is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
So again, no additional disclosures here. We'll talk a little bit about some of the mass effects of malignancy. Now, this is a little bit more of a clinical presentation. We kind of got that heavy lifting stuff out of the way, and we can roll up our sleeves and kind of dig into this a little bit. Tumors are going to produce clinical problems as a result of local expansion with obliteration of normal tissues as the malignant cells proliferate within the confines of an organ. And we can see in this CT scan that you can see the patient has a rather large spleen, which shows up on our right, the patient's left, and compares very favorably with the liver that sits on the opposite side. So as you might imagine, they could give you a scan like this and say, this patient has experienced weight loss from early satiety and has had drenching night sweats. What would your diagnosis be? Well, with splenomegaly and early satiety as a result of the greater curvature of the stomach bouncing up against that spleen, this is a patient who's likely to have a lymphoma with a fairly substantial investment in the spleen. And so as a result of that, it might be an indolent lymphoma for which something like a CD20 monoclonal antibody such as rituximab might be effective. And as it turns out, this was a patient of mine who presented with just those symptoms a few years ago. And he got his first dose of rituximab, did very well with it, came to the office for the next treatment, and his spleen was no longer palpable, and his wife was complaining that she had to spend $400 at the store in the last week because she couldn't fill him up. So it's amazing how profound the response can be in patients if we can get some sort of favorable response in that regard. Paraneoplastic syndromes. Now, we don't really have too much time to delve into this, unfortunately, with respect to this lecture. I would make a couple of quick comments, and one would be that the optimal treatment for the paraneoplastic syndrome is treatment of the underlying malignancy. Second thing I would say is look at these four things on this list: Eaton-Lambert, SIADH, hypercalcemia, and erythrocytosis. If you can grab 30 minutes during your review time to sit down with something like UpToDate or Harrison's or whatever it is that you like to use for your preparation, and just read a little bit of a short blurb, just, you know, 5 to 7 minutes would be all that you'd need on those, you'll probably pick up two or three board questions right then and there. They love paraneoplastic syndromes. I wish we had time to really get in greater detail with it. We will talk about a little bit of these during the course itself. So that plus just a 30-minute brief review for those four topics, I think, will serve you well. Weight loss associated with anorexia is a frequent problem, and I think when we think of the patient with cancer, that's the thing that really stands out in this patient population. We see this wasting that occurs. It's a loss of visceral protein stores. It's known as cachexia. We're still scratching our heads about exactly what drives it, but I think it's probably fair to say that it's a combination of some sort of paraneoplastic syndrome in and of itself, combined with just the effects of the malignancy on the body itself, the mass effects and things like that. We've got two potential chemicals that have been implicated. One is cachectin, also known as tumor necrosis factor. It's a protein that can cause cachexia in laboratory animals. It's been found in high levels in patients with advanced cancer. The second is proteolysis-inducing factor, found in serum and urine of cachectic cancer patients. And so we've got two agents that we have implicated. We also know that these patients have abnormalities of taste and smell. They've had physiologic malfunction of the GI tract, just didn't seem to want to work as well. There are excessive energy demands that are made by the tumor because it's competing with the normal cells of the body for nutrients. And there's failure to adapt energy expenditure to the levels of nutrient intake. So how do you treat it? Well, again, when and where you can, you want to try to treat the underlying disease. We've tried medications to stimulate appetite, and dronabinol and megestrol acetate have both been marketed in that regard. Well, as it turns out, dronabinol has an improvement of 0.6 kilograms, no lean body weight developed. It's mostly water and fat. With megestrol acetate, marketed under the trade name of Megace, it's actually on the beers list as being more harmful than effective. The number needed to treat is 12. You will see somebody start to improve their appetite if you treat 12 patients. And number needed for someone to die is 20. So Megace has a 5% mortality rate. And these people already are fighting for their lives, and so we've actually looked at this medication as something that's more harmful than beneficial, particularly in cancer patients, and so it's not used anymore. Fever is usually attributable to infection. The type of infection can be unusual, though, because we've got cancer-related debility and granulocytopenia that often develops from our treatment. Infections from endogenous organisms has to be considered. But every once in a while, you're going to run into that patient who just pops up fevers for no apparent reason, and we have to think about the possibility of increased production of interleukin-1. Back in the old days when I was in school, we called it endogenous pyrogen, and it's tumor-related fever or tumor fever. It can be amenable to a wide variety of agents, steroids, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents, acetaminophen, pretty much anything you want to try can help alleviate some of the symptoms. Obviously, again, the best treatment when possible is to treat the underlying disease. Make quick mention of some hematologic abnormalities in solid tumor patients. Sherry's has discussed some of this already. Anemia is more frequent in patients with advanced stages of malignancy. There's increased destruction of erythrocytes from hypersplenism, microangiopathic hemolysis, autoantibodies, those sorts of things that we can see. Anemia due to bleeding, of course, is one of the cardinal findings of gastrointestinal malignancies. Nutritional defects can result in decreased red cell production as well. The bone marrow is an extremely active organ, and it can be very sensitive to things. And if you have patients who aren't eating well, aren't getting along very well, or are struggling with their treatment, it can decrease substantially the amount of production of red blood cells. And of course, the anemia of chronic disease is often present. Hepcidin or hepcidin, you hear both those terms kind of used interchangeably. It's the same sort of same thing. But what we have found in patients who have advanced malignancies is that hepcidin levels can be very high in patients who have advanced malignancies. That's anemia of chronic disease almost by definition. It's the same sort of picture that we see in that patient population. And on occasion, you can get the bone marrow actually infiltrated with malignancy. And so here's a picture of one of the patients that I took care of probably 15 or 20 years ago. She had a history of breast cancer, had been treated to remission by one of my partners before I joined the group, had been in remission for about 10 years when she presented with unexplained anemia. Normal iron stores, B12 and folate were fine, reticulocyte count was low. She had felt great, and on her clinical examination, really nothing that would point to anemia. And so I said, you know, I think probably what we need to do is do a bone marrow examination. Let's investigate this, because nothing else is popping up. So on her marrow examination, under the microscope, here were these adenocarcinoma cells, and I had the pathologist stain for estrogen and progesterone receptors. They were 95% positive, and she had had a recurrence of her breast cancer in her bone marrow. So we put her on an aromatase inhibitor, and within 2 months, she was transfusion independent. Within 4 months, her hemoglobin was normal. And so we were, you know, we'd successfully treated her malignancy, which we followed by using her anemia as a surrogate marker for tumor response. Kind of an odd situation, but it's a testimonial to the nature of how you have to think about the whole process, how the marrow works, how this all fits together in the context of the patient can be very helpful. Coagulopathies. Again, Sherry's talked about this as well. Mucin-producing adenocarcinomas are the world's worst enemy. They cause a lot of these. You might read about Trousseau syndrome. Trousseau syndrome, known as phlegmatous cerulea dolens, is migratory thrombophlebitis. Those patients are at increased risk for DVT and pulmonary embolus. And so those patients are going to have migratory changes in many cases. Trousseau's original paper documented several cases of this. One-third of Trousseau's population of patients ultimately developed malignancy, and Trousseau himself suffered from this late in life and ultimately died as a result of pancreatic cancer. Trousseau's complication was the syndrome for which he actually named. So it's one of those interesting things in recent medical history that kind of helps cement the nature of the disease and why we need to be aware of it. Treatment of the primary malignancy, again, it's the only successful therapeutic attack. Low molecular weight heparin. American Society of Clinical Oncology standard of care says if you have patients with thromboembolic disease in the face of malignancy, low molecular weight heparins are the best management tool in that situation. So let's turn next to working these patients up. They may give you a case on the boards where they say, okay, your patient presents with A, B, and C. Where do you go here? Well, our goal is to do three major things. Number one, we want to biopsy tissue to establish a diagnosis. Number two, we want to stage the patient. That gives us the extent of the tumor. And number three, we want to determine the effects of malignancy on the overall health and performance of the patient, something that we refer to as performance status. And I'll be talking a little bit about palliative oncology a little later this morning and getting into some of that in a little bit greater detail. There's four diagnostic tests that can be helpful in terms of cancer screening. Those are pap smears, fecal occult blood testing with periodic sigmoidoscopy, mammograms, and low-dose helical CT scan of the chest in smokers age 55 to 75 for lung cancer. So we'll talk a little bit next about chemotherapy. They will have some chemotherapy questions on the boards, and so you'll need to be able to pick these drugs out and understand how they work and why. Let's talk a little bit first about the biology of tumor growth. It follows Gompertzian kinetics, and so as we see the mass increase, there's exponential retardation of growth to occur. We don't really measure tumor doubling times much anymore. It's sometimes done in labs, but it's a purely academic basic science exercise. But essentially what we're trying to describe is the amount of time it takes for tumors to go through an entire cell cycle. Some of those tumors can grow very, very rapidly. For example, Burkitt lymphoma is the fastest growing cancer that we know. It has a tumor doubling time of 36 hours. Very, very fast. Patients oftentimes will come in and say it just popped up out of nowhere. Contrast that with some of our other cancers where tumor doubling times could be measured in months or even in years. The average number of divisions for a cancer to become clinically apparent is 30. That's one malignant cell becoming two malignant cells. There's one doubling. Two malignant cells become four. There's two doublings and so forth and so on. That's about 1 × 10⁹ cells. The average number of cell divisions for a cancer to be lethal, which is what we're seeing out here on this curve, is 10^12 cells. And so by the time we detect the cancer, it's lived 75% of its lifespan between the time we detect it and the time there's enough cancer to kill somebody. So you can see how narrow the window really is. If we treat the cancer, what we hope to do is to get successive reductions in tumor mass so that we can make the cancer go away, and hopefully those patients can be cured or at least achieve sustaining remissions. And so this Gompertzian growth curve is important, and you'll see Sherry and I and our oncology and hematology colleagues out there on the side of this curve with our lunchbox and our thermos of coffee, trying to see if we can get some sort of improvement in the lives of our patients by lowering their tumor burden and giving them a better chance for quality life, survivability, and hopefully in as many cases as possible, we can have cure. In order to administer chemotherapy, we have to first kind of go back to our first year, maybe even, if you're like me, even more remote, to the cell cycle. The reason why that matters is because there are two times during which chemotherapy can be used. It can be used during mitosis, when separation of nuclear material occurs, or in the S phase, when duplication of nuclear material occurs. And so we kind of all remember this picture and how it all goes in. And we've probably tried to forget this picture because we feel like we're on to other things that we enjoy a little bit more. But here it is again. So we've got two growth phases, the S phase or synthesis phase, and then the mitosis phase. Chemotherapy is going to affect cells in direct relationship to how active they are in that cell cycle. So for our classes of drugs, we tend to break them into cell cycle specific and cell cycle non-specific therapies. Alkylating agents are our biggest class, and you might remember in the previous lecture I made mention that they're also a major culprit in terms of chemotherapy-induced malignancy. So it's a good news, bad news sort of thing for alkylators. Alkylating agents bind directly to DNA, and they can cause cross-strand breaks that disrupt transcription and replication. Drugs like meclaresamine, also known as nitrogen mustard, which we used to use for Hodgkin's disease, cyclophosphamide, the nitrosoureas that we've used historically for treatment of brain tumors, and the platinum derivatives, cisplatin, carboplatin, and other platinum-containing agents are examples of that. Now, most of these are going to be cell cycle non-specific. They're kind of just kill cells indiscriminately. They're not really tied into what's going on with the cell cycle. The anti-metabolites are working a little bit differently. They compete with normal precursors for the catalytic site of enzymes or substitute for metabolites that are incorporated into DNA or RNA. So you might imagine that if they're going to do something like that, they're probably going to work at a specific point, and you would be correct. These are cell cycle specific agents. And these are drugs that kind of sound like nucleic acids, some of them. Methotrexate, and then here's it interferes with folic acid metabolism, so it's going to have to work in a specific spot. Pemetrexed does that as well. 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, well, there's a nucleic acid. Okay, so it's got to be pretty specific. Ara-C, hard to fit that in, but Ara-C is also known as cytosine arabinoside. Gemcitabine, difluorodeoxycytidine was the name it was originally marketed under. 6-mercaptopurine, another nucleic acid. 6-thioguanine, there it is again. So these are examples of agents that would fit in under the category of anti-metabolites. Believe it or not, there were some drugs that were initially studied for their antibiotic purposes that we found out were effective for chemotherapy. Now, antibiotics intercalate with DNA, and they cause inhibition of transcription and replication, and they also inhibit topoisomerase II. For those of you who may not be familiar with what topoisomerases do, there's a lot of DNA folding that goes on. As we know, the strand of DNA is several feet in length, and yet it's got to be compacted and folded and put into a nucleus that's really, really small. It's microscopic. And that's what the topoisomerases do. So they will unfold portions of DNA for the purposes of copying information, and then they'll hook it up and fold it back in. So anything that would interfere with that affects a cell's ability to grow and to divide. Doxorubicin, which we now know more commonly as Adriamycin, Donorubicin, Actinomycin D, Bleomycin, these are all examples. Probably in this list, the only one that would be currently used would be Doxorubicin or Donorubicin. There's also another Epirubicin that's sometimes used in breast cancer as well. Don't use antibiotics quite as much as we used to back in the good old days. Plant alkaloids. If you're growing vincas or periwinkles around your house, good news, you're growing chemotherapy right there in your front yard. Things like vincristine, vinblastine, vindazine, vinorelbine, these are all plant alkaloids. They come from vincas. So that's where you can kind of remember the name, because they all have vin in them. Vincristine, vinblastine. These bind to tubulin and cause impairment of microtubule formation. Etoposide, VP16, inhibits topoisomerase II, and that causes single-strand breaks in DNA. So again, something else to sabotage the cancer cell's abilities. These two are going to be cell cycle specific, because as you read about how they work at very specific sites. We also have hormonal agents that really work a little differently than many of the other chemotherapeutic agents that we have. Tamoxifen is a drug that binds to and blocks estrogen receptors, and that's its primary goal. Other drugs like leuprolide and goserelin are luteinizing hormone-releasing hormone agonists that decrease secretion of luteinizing hormone that lowers sex hormone production. Flutamide, bicalutamide, there's a new one out there now that's just a little too early to talk about, but flutamide and bicalutamide are most likely to show up on the boards this year or next year. It's kind of like tamoxifen for men. It binds to and blocks testosterone receptors. And we also have aromatase inhibitors, anastrozole, exemestane, and letrozole that decrease sex hormone production by the adrenal gland. These are only effective in women who are postmenopausal. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, because in premenopausal women, most of the estrogen production is provided by the ovaries. And so when the ovaries go offline during menopause, now the primary source of what estrogen production may remain is going to be carried out by the adrenal glands. And so aromatase inhibitors work by blocking conversion of androgens to estrogen. We've also got a number of biological agents that are out there, interferons and interleukins. We know they work somehow with the body's immune system, and they create certain scenarios that can be tumoricidal, but it's not entirely clear how they work. More recently, we've developed epidermal growth factor inhibitors. Erlotinib has some minimal efficacy in non-small cell lung cancer. Cetuximab, also known as Erbitux, has been effective in lung, head and neck, colorectal cancers. We only use cetuximab in those patients who have KRAS wild-type colorectal carcinomas. And then we've got the tyrosine kinase inhibitors, things like imatinib, that are effective in CML. But as it turns out, the same sort of genetic defect exists in a particular type of low-grade sarcoma, the colon and the rectum and the intestines, known as a GI stromal tumor. These agents have been very effective in that patient population as well. We also have monoclonal antibodies, and oncologists aren't the only ones who play in this wheelhouse. Our rheumatology colleagues and GI colleagues use these agents fairly frequently in their line of work as well. These are targets, targeted therapies directed with respect to oncology and a specific specific target on a cancer cell. So things like rituximab, anti-CD20, it's an anti-lymphocyte agent. It's effective in the lymphomas and in chronic lymphocytic leukemia. Cetuximab, we've already mentioned, it's directed at epidermal growth factor receptor, affects tyrosine kinase activity as well. Other agents that can be tagged with radioisotopes, they've really not seemed to gather too much traction in oncology circles. They had some promise about 20 years ago, but have kind of fizzled ever since then. But you may still run across a question or two on the boards, and so it's why I want to make you aware that things like radioisotope labeled monoclonal antibodies are an effective tool for refractory lymphomas. It's still available and still something to consider. We also have some newer targeted therapies, and we've learned a whole lot about these programmed cell death antibodies and how they work. The first target that we ever had was with a kind of a cumbersome name by the name of CTLA-4. Our drug that we had available was a drug called ipilimumab. It was very useful in melanoma. And then we subsequently developed agents that were directed at PD-1 and the ligand of PD-1, known as PD-L1, drugs like nivolumab and pembrolizumab, and then azetilizumab, avelumab, and durvalumab. Good luck saying that, but at least if you can get them in front of you and you can recognize them on the board exams, these are relatively new agents. This space did not exist on the oncologist shelf 5 or 6 years ago. So we're still learning a little bit about how they work and how we can utilize them. But as it turns out, we've now got immunologic therapy available for non-small cell lung cancer, and these are the things that they're advertising on TV all the time. And we think that this is changing the face of lung cancer, because generally with patients with non-small cell lung cancer, we take care of them for about a year. And if they were doing really, really well and stayed really, really active, we might get a year and a half or 2 years. Well, we've got patients that we're following now 4, 5, and 6 years, some of them even longer than that, That's something that we never saw with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. And so we know these agents are effective because these patients are coming in and telling us all the wonderful things they're doing. These are agents that are finding a niche in a lot of other malignancies as well. So kidney cancer, certainly bladder cancer, where it's really beginning to make its voice known, head and neck cancers, Hodgkin's lymphoma, and there are going to be some others as well. So this is part of the oncology literature that just for general use, for the practicing internist, this is a niche that you want to follow because your patients are going to come in taking these medications. Then, as we'll talk about during the course of the morning, there are some side effects and toxicities that are associated with that as well. So this is kind of the game plan as it currently lays out. And as you can see in this slide, there are several other potential targets. So these are things over here in red that are just not quite ready for prime time, but they're coming. So how these relate together, how they work together, when to do it, when not to, these are all things that we're going to be learning about in the next 10 to 20 years. Complications of chemotherapy, you will need to be familiar with these. In general, chemotherapy tends to affect cells that grow rapidly, whether they're normal or abnormal. So constitutional complaints, to some degree, are going to occur in over 90% of the patients that we treat. Fatigue, weakness, and lassitude are very common complaints. Patients oftentimes will describe a flu-like feeling that'll last for a few days after their treatment. Anorexia. Sometimes it's hard to tell. We know that we make people's food taste funny. We know that we can give it a metallic taste. 5-fluorouracil and other fluorinated pyrimidines are notorious for that. We can give people other reasons to not eat that we'll mention here just momentarily. But sometimes it's hard to tell if it's the cancer or if it's the treatment. Probably sometimes it's a combination of both. The primary culprits for GI toxicity are going to be alkylating agents and anti-metabolites. Nausea and vomiting can occur, but fortunately it's very uncommon with the newer antiemetics that we're using. Diarrhea, you can certainly get this, and we see mucositis as well in a lot of our patients, and so you can look in their mouths. Now, this is not just a fever blister or something like that. You can see this denuding and superficial ulceration throughout the mouth, and the problem is that they've also got an esophagus, a stomach, and about 25 feet of small and large intestine that look the same way in certain cases. And so these patients will come in and they'll complain of difficulty eating, painful swallowing. They will also come in complaining of nausea and vomiting. They will have diarrhea associated with it. In more severe cases of mucositis, you can even have people come in with bloody diarrhea. So these sorts of things can happen with these agents. Hepatitis B virus reactivation has been reported with anti-CD20 antibodies. So if they give you a patient with a lymphoma and they don't give you any disclaimers and it's CD20 positive and they don't give you any reason to worry about hepatitis B reactivation, you're probably going to be okay. If there's anything in there that even hints about the possibility of hepatitis B virus, you want to make sure that you look for hepatitis B virus reactivation, because if those patients start up with anti-CD20 therapy, it can reactivate their hepatitis B. So you kind of got to be on your toes with that one. Respiratory complaints. These are agents we don't use much anymore, but busulfan, bleomycin, mitomycin C. Pulmonary fibrosis is the concern with these patients. Their PFTs, especially their DLCO, are almost always abnormal. Patients sometimes can get radiation recall. These are interstitial infiltrates in previously irradiated lung. When you use subsequent chemotherapy, the big culprit here is going to be adriamycin. Dermatologic changes, something we have to keep an eye out for. 5-FU, cisplatin, adriamycin, all of these increase the risk for skin exposure, and so sunlight increases the risk for sunburn. I work in a largely agricultural community, so I'm all the time telling the farmers and people who are working outdoors and people on utility trucks, make sure you're wearing good sunscreen. Hand-foot syndrome, the name describes the disorder. Hands and feet, palm of the hands, soles of the feet. Most commonly we'll see this with 5-FU. Hands become painfully swollen and can desquamate if they get severe. Acral erythema, not hand-foot syndrome. This is different. This is the tips of the digits. They become erythematous and painful. So the tips of the fingers, the tips of the toes, and in males, the tip of the, yep, you guessed it. So you got to make sure in men that you're asking them if they're having voiding complaints, if they're having any issues with discomfort, or if they have any concerns. So it's kind of what it looks like too. And it's not a lot of fun. Good hand moisturizers, the things that you can use, bag balm, you can use Noxzema, pretty much any sort of hand moisturizers you use are going to work pretty well. Rash, dermatologic, can happen with targeted therapies, and here we think about EGFR inhibitors. Imatinib, gefitinib, erlotinib, cetuximab, and this is a patient who actually comes from the package insert for I think for cetuximab. So it's marketed under the trade name Erbitux, and I just kind of tell our students and residents, that's what Erba rash looks like. So you've just kind of got to be on your toes. Pretty substantial rash. Genitourinary, they might give you a patient who's undergone chemotherapy and now has hemorrhagic cystitis. What drug caused it? Or a patient who's received chemotherapy with a platinum agent and now their BUN and creatinine are going up. Well, that's nephrotoxicity from the platinum. So think in terms of making sure that those patients stay hydrated. We tend to see kidney problems a lot more commonly with cisplatin than we do with carboplatin and the other platinum derivatives. Cyclophosphamide in commonly used doses, not so much the dose that you might use for some of the rheumatologic diseases, but the doses that we're using, which are going to be 50 to 150 percent of what you're using for most of the rheumatologic diseases, that's pretty standard cyclophosphamide. But some of these conditioning regimens for stem cell transplants, you'll be administering multiple grams of cyclophosphamide, and it can cause hemorrhagic cystitis. Ifosfamide, which is being used a little bit less these days, kind of the evil twin of cyclophosphamide, it can cause hemorrhagic cystitis at any dose. And so we have to vigorously hydrate all of these patients. If we're giving ifosfamide, there is a radical scavenger known as Mesna. It's scavenging for a chemical known as acrolein that's excreted to the bladder. And essentially, it's sitting in the bladder and just contact irritant. And that's where they get the hemorrhagic cystitis. So the other key to that is encouraging patients to empty their bladder frequently. Those things can minimize the risk. Seizures have been reported with high-dose busulfan. Well, we don't use busulfan much anymore, so there may be a little safety barrier, but I'd still kind of be aware of that. We do see patients all the time who have paresthesias and dysesthesias, and it can, if we're not careful in monitoring patients, progress to hyporeflexia, vinca alkaloids, cisplatin, and taxanes. And so we're not getting rid of our neurohammers and our tuning forks anytime soon. We test our patients as well. CNS disturbances, psychoses, hallucinations, leukoencephalopathy, doesn't just happen to people sitting for their boards. It happens in our patient population too. There's rare, fortunately, but with those patients who receive central nervous system chemotherapy, combined radiation chemotherapy, anti-CD20 monoclonal antibodies, a real concern. Also, there's immunologic neuropathy. I've made mention about things like the PD-1 inhibitors and the things that they can do. Guillain-Barré syndrome reactivation, transverse myelitis reactivation. Those are things that you need to be aware of. We've kind of talked a little bit about hematologic toxicity, so I won't spend any time here. I would just point out that you remember that neutropenic fever is a medical emergency. Mortality rate 1 to 4% per hour that the fever goes untreated. What's the mortality rate for acute myocardial infarction? 1 to 4% per hour that the MI goes unrecognized and untreated. So neutropenic fever has the same mortality rate as acute myocardial infarction, so we need to approach it with the same degree of medical urgency. A couple of quick comments on endocrine, and then we'll get Dr. Kowalski back up. Hypophysitis can occur with ipilimumab. Hypothyroidism can occur with PD-1 and PD-L1 directed agents. These patients just don't get get it for a few days. You know, like all of you, I went through general internal medicine training. I'm certified in general internal medicine. If I'm treating a patient and I cause a flare-up in their thyroid or I cause a little bit of hypophysitis, it's pretty much self-limited. I can get them through that. But this type of problem with these agents can persist for months. I'm pretty good with hypophysitis for a couple of weeks. I don't know how good I'd do with it with six to nine months or more. So we get our subspecialty consultants on board to help us manage the long-term complications of this. Fever secondary to chemotherapy, it certainly can happen. Think about VP16 interferons and interleukins. Medicating patients is probably the best way to manage that. Vesicants, this is when drugs tend to leak out and cause extravasation. Most commonly methotrexate and Adriamycin can be our culprits, which is why we use really good central line access for those patients.